Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing WatsonX Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with WatsonX Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
You're listening to Comedy Central.
Is a best-selling author whose new book is called Grief is for People. Please welcome Sloane Crosley. Sloane.
All right.
Huh?
Hi. Hello.
How you feeling?
I feel pretty great. How do you feel?
I feel great. I'm excited
to
talk with you.
Yeah.
This book is beautiful and wonderful. You write, before this book, a lot of essays involving humor. This is a memoir involving loss and grief with a lot of humor in it.
Yes.
I laugh, but how do you strike that balance between grief and laughing?
I know. I can't believe I'm here talking about the sad book.
Yeah.
No, I think that the sort of topography of grief that everyone experiences, the people you miss because they're so specific.
Yeah.
And in this case, the person I miss was very dark and very funny.
Yeah.
And so you have both my cylinder of humor going and his going at the same time.
You mention Russell, but really, when you start this book, it's about being burglarized.
I know. So many bad things
happen. Again, there's a lot of laughing. There is a lot of laughing.
For real.
I mean, but one of the most interesting parts of the book is how it turns. And tell me a little bit about, you know, how you approach that from being robbed to then this next bad thing that happened.
Yeah. So basically in on June 27th of 2019, I left my apartment for 1 hour to get a hand x-ray. So I took all my rings off.
Right.
I mean, what are you going to do? And came home to find all my jewelry gone, burglarized.
Right.
And not particularly flashy, just gone. And then a month later, my dearest friend unfortunately died by suicide. So that first loss obviously became the sort of more minor precursor to the second loss. But I, as a human being, I am deeply unlucky. But as a, in this case, I am.
Yeah.
But as a writer of this book, I knew this is a suspenseful story about grief, and it's a funny story about grief, and I don't think you get a lot of those. So.
Yeah, and it's easy to grieve at first for these items.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, if you have been...
I mean, it sucked.
It sucks. I mean, it's, you know, we had some winter coats stolen, and I'm almost embarrassed.
Winter coats stolen.
Yeah, we had winter coats stolen.
I'm so
almost,
sorry
that's
for your
okay.
loss.
Exactly. Exactly. It is humorous in a way, but also you feel violated, you feel mad.
Yes.
And then as soon as anything real happens, you go, that's the important thing.
Yes, well, it's also the only commonality that these two losses have is the sudden nature of them.
Yeah.
It just felt like a real demarcation of before and after, which you don't always get with grief.
Tell me about Russell. You tell a lot of, in the book, but...
On national television,
yeah, please.
I'd be glad
share,
to.
Share
just
Russell
like anyone
with
would about their friend.
Yeah.
So I used to work in book publishing. He hired me. I worked for him for 10 years. He was a wildly generous, funny, brilliant publicist, and deeply inappropriate. I'm really hesitant to repeat some of the lines in the book.
Yeah.
You know, he fits sort of less and less, I think, in a world that he had helped built in a way. And part of the challenge of this book was how to memorialize and pay tribute to someone like that without sounding like a frustrated septuagenarian white man who's like, it's just not the same.
Right, right. You know, the world has changed.
The world has changed. But he was just a wonderful, well-read human being who really was almost like, you know, he's my partner in crime.
Yeah.
I felt like that. People have that with work relationships and friends.
I love when you talk about some of his quote-unquote offensive, whatever they were, remarks, actions. I mean, he sent you an email once as your cat or something? Was that what it was?
Oh, yeah, the whole account.
Yeah, the whole account.
It would say, like, Mommy, why are you wearing the same thing you wore yesterday?
Right.
Mommy, why didn't you come home last night?
Right.
This is my boss, just so
that's so
clear.
Awesome. I mean...
also, like, my dear, wonderful friend.
Yeah, and what HR doesn't get is...
won't kill them.
Right. Well, it's when someone is gone, it's these hilarious, sometimes they cross the line moments that we think about and we laugh about.
Yes. And now, having said that, I'm not trying to be permissive over some of the behavior that he exhibited.
Sure.
But also, it didn't come, those things that we're talking about didn't, they weren't attached to, you know, sort of abuses of power or lording sex over people or anything like that. He fought for everyone's raises, you know.
Right. You talk about lack of self-help books or grieving groups for loss of a friend.
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, I would say it's not like anyone was trying to take my grief away from me. You know, nobody was like, well, you don't get to grieve.
Right.
Too bad.
Just a friend.
Yeah,
you don't get to do that.
Sit in the corner. No, but it just felt like the structure of life, of the self-help books, of the internet, is very much loss of a spouse, loss of a child, God forbid, you know, loss of a parent. And so in addition to being so confused and hurt by his death, I had this sort of extra patina of thinking, do I have a right to this? How much, I'm trying to get purchase on it. How much of it is mine? And turns out about 200 pages worth is mine.
Yeah. It can feel very serious, but there's humor. And are you looking for the humor, or are you a person who writes your truth, the world you're in, and humor's there?
This whole thing?
That whole thing,
No, I mean, the truth is I have always been a
humor writer.
I'm
asking not for them, because I'm curious.
Yeah.
Because it's like, do you try to be
not
funny?
For them.
Yeah, not for them. Do you try to be funny in this serious situation?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't.
Yeah.
I think that what I have, and what I imagine you have as well, in replace of poetry, maybe, are analogies and observations and sort of this abject exasperation at the world. And that's how I see and describe the world.
Yeah.
So the humor, you know, in my more traditional humor essays, there's a better sort of alignment, I suppose, between the topic and how I'm telling the story. With a grief book, I think it hopefully gives the book more texture and or will offend massive amounts of people.
No, it won't. It's not. It's an excellent read. Why are we afraid to say grief? Why are we afraid to talk about it? Yeah. I find talking about death, especially in North American culture, it's like, keep it down.
Yeah.
Why? Tell me the answer to this existential question.
Oh, that
yes,
I'm...
that's why you're here.
I'm specifically...
No, but you have a good input on... You have a good thought on...
On how to speak to people who are grieving? Or,
yeah.
So I...
And why, sorry, on why it is that we talk about it so little. Why is there a little bit of an air right now?
A squeamishness.
Because there's grief and there's sadness.
Well, especially the kind of death this is very scary.
Yeah.
When we say... We don't necessarily say... your cancer, ah, cancer. We do say ah, suicide, or your suicide, his suicide. It's like we give it. It's like hot coal, and we give it back to the dead person as fast as we possibly can.
Right.
And I think because we're frightened for ourselves, as we well should be.
Yeah.
But I think the only way around that is to discuss it more and to talk about it and to be asked questions about it.
Yeah.
You know, in the wake of Russell's death, people would often say, "Did you know?"
Right.
Which I personally don't have the best reaction to, because I don't know if it's for me or for him.
Yeah.
But I like to talk about it.
What should you say?
Well, I mean, first of all, you should say whatever the hell you want to say.
Right.
As long as it's, I'm not trying to police people's reaction to grief, as long as it's authentic and it's sincere and not just sort of rubbernecking at a horror story and using your, you know, grief for this. I think you should just go with declarative statements.
Yeah.
You did.
Okay.
Where you said, you know, you said, tell me about him.
Right.
I wish I knew him.
Right.
He must have been wonderful. What a big life that's more than this one moment.
That's beautiful. Yeah. I've heard you say part of grief is becoming on the side of the living once again. Explain that to me.
Well, if you've ever grieved someone, you know that especially right away, there's this sort of almost embarrassing thing I felt, which is I was receiving all of these wonderful condolences and I felt like I was ill-equipped or did not have the shelving to accept them because everybody had committed the sin of not being able to bring my friend back.
Right.
And I just wanted to do whatever he wanted to do. So we had a memorial service.
Right.
I turned into what I call in the book a funeralzilla.
Right.
Where I was just like, is it hard to shut down Fifth Avenue for an hour?
Right.
Maybe we should.
Right.
Why are these programs not bound with ribbon?
Right.
Where is the gold leaf? You know, and I'm like, okay, somebody needed to sort of pull me aside and say, you know, he's not going to be going to the memorial service. And honestly, at that moment, no, I did not know that.
Right. So is it like changing that focus to back to present tense? Yeah.
Yes, and I also changing to what he would want.
Yeah.
Do you know? Because again, even and especially with someone who dies by suicide, they are more than their last act of free will.
Yeah.
And we had an entire friendship and an entire life together where I know that he wanted more from me than to just focus on him.
Yeah. It's a beautiful book. You will laugh. You will think, I promise you. But it's also a tribute to your friend, Russell. Thank you for chatting with us very much. I appreciate
it.
Grief is for People is available now. Sloan Crosley, everybody. And we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. Thank you. My guest tonight is a University of Kentucky basketball legend and an NBA shooting star who has written a memoir called It's Hard for Me to Live with Me. Please welcome Rex Chapman.
Thanks for having me.
This book, you lay it out. You are, I know you from basketball. Some people know you from social media. You have a podcast. In this book, you talk about your addiction, your recovery. How difficult was it for you to write that?
People have been telling me I should write a book for a long time.
Yeah.
I never really understood why.
Yeah.
And then Seth Davis, the guy who author who co-wrote the book with me.
Yeah.
I've known Seth a long time. He called me up. I had a level of comfort that I don't know that I had with a lot of other people.
Yeah.
And we started the process. We started it probably, I told somebody today, I think it was like 2 years ago.
Yeah.
It was like 4 years ago because about a year in, Seth said, hey man, I've got another project that's kind of time sensitive. Do you mind? I said, no, I don't like talking about this anyway. So take all the time you want. I said, sure, what is it? He said, well, it's Sister Jean, who's 104 years old. And I laughed. I said, that's the sweetest thing ever that you think I might outlive Sister Jean. anyway, there we go.
Man, I resonated with so much of this. You're incredibly honest. One of the things that jumped out at me was you broke the rules and oftentimes the law a lot before kind of the big bottom.
Yeah.
I mean, there was cheating in school. There was cheating on
your
girlfriend.
That's not against the law.
There was driving with a suspended license. There was breaking tons of curfews. Every single
time. Rule breaker.
But then it really seemed like it all crashed in 2014 when you get arrested for stealing from an Apple store. Is that right? No, not you. Okay. But I mean, by the way, I didn't just bring you out here to tell you all the shit you did. I'm asking a question and I should probably get to it. The perks of being an athlete and being a successful athlete, is that what allowed you to...
I think so. Just talking about it in the green room, really, with Larry Hughes, my Simon & Schuster guy. My last 2 years of high school, I have dyslexia, and I didn't know any of that, though. Right. I just knew higher math and science and all that stuff. I would sort of check out, like, how are you guys getting this? This is not easy. And then I'm being told it's kind of common sense.
Yeah.
And I just kind of, I quit. I'm not going to be a math teacher. Why do I need to know this?
Right.
And so that was, and then I'd cheat.
Yeah.
But my last 2 years of high school, I just left school early after lunch. And because I was a good basketball player, like even in high school, well, they can't afford to sit me.
Right.
What kind of craziness is that? But I left. And the only time I got in trouble, the assistant principal called me in one day after school. For 2 years, I've done this. And I thought I was in trouble. And he said, listen, Rex, I don't mind you going home after lunch.
Right.
But don't be washing your car out there when the school buses are coming by in the afternoon. Well,
this also shows how good you were at basketball.
Well,
because, you know, maybe I could put up 7 points, but if I skip school, they're like, hey, Costa, you're not that good.
Yeah, you but listen, man, you played tennis, and you played it at a very high level.
That's right.
Going and playing, you know, you did. He really did. He went to Illinois and played tennis. and anybody that goes to college and plays a sport, Division I, Division II especially, that's all your time.
That's right.
I didn't really have the, I didn't have the probably the capacity for the school part of it.
Right.
But I was having to go every day.
Right.
And I remember sitting in class, because it takes all your time.
Yeah.
And for me back in the day, we could only play basketball like 3-4 hours a day by rule. And so I'd be in a geography of Kentucky class, sitting
there. It's such a complicated class.
And I'd be sitting there and thinking, well, Reggie Miller, Clyde Drexler, Michael Jordan, Ron Harper, all these guys are working out right now.
Right.
And I'm stuck in this class.
Yeah.
And it's my only avenue to get where they are.
Yeah.
And I have to do what is being told, you know, probably cheating on my tests weren't the best thing, but I only did that once.
But as I read this, it, man, you worked hard. You know, you were going
at night.
I was
obsessed by it.
Yeah, but you were getting a key to the gym at night and having you and your buddy and have him rebound for you.
Yeah.
I mean, you might have been a rule breaker.
No,
but
was
the
only thing that I had. That was the only thing I felt like I could control.
Yeah.
And I worked at it. I was obsessed by it. I told someone earlier, I used to wake up at midnight on the East Coast.
Yeah.
I'd fallen asleep, wake up just in a sweat thinking, my guy, Gerald Madkin, somebody I know out in L.A., my grade, he's at the park right now. It's 9 o'clock. I need to do some push-ups. Let me go run a mile. I'll come back and go to bed. Like, obsessed like that. Somebody's working harder, and I can't allow that.
So that same level of commitment, that stubbornness, that anxiety over working, does that help you in recovery? Or in a way, is it like, is it hard to go to recovery because I'm a bad motherfucker? I can beat this.
Well,
I know I can beat this.
I think that's probably the mindset that got me there.
Right.
You know, I for sure went through, you know, very first when I started taking Vicodin or OxyContin, I just remember one day very vividly thinking, can I cuss?
Yeah, you can cuss. I think I already said
I say all of
those? Yeah.
Okay. I thought to myself, shit.
Right.
No, I thought...
You played against Michael Jordan. You've heard,
heard
worse
it all.
Than all this.
I've heard it all.
Yeah.
But I was thinking, all of a sudden, you know, I was taking this medicine. It was saying take it once every whatever.
Yeah.
All this, and where I'm making that call, all of a sudden, one day, it just flipped where that medicine was telling me when to take it.
Yeah.
And before I know it, I was only supposed to take 3 today. Now I'm to 4, and now I'm to 5. And then I get to 7 or 8, and I go, this is an issue, man.
Yeah.
And I cut it down to 4 or 5, and then guess what? Maybe an argument or whatever.
Right.
And then I'm like, f*** this.
Right.
And then that was from the time I was 15 or 16 year old, though, I started having some depression and whatnot and really started coping that way then because I didn't know how to cope.
Yeah.
I would well, I would sneak off to the racetrack all the time, bet horses. That was what my dad and I always did. I just thought it was normal.
He talks a lot about in this book, not just the pills, but also a horse racing.
Yeah, that's my. I liked basketball. I love thoroughbred racing. Yeah. So.
And the only horses these people know are the ones at Central Park.
Yeah. But, I like those too.
Let's talk about, because as you're talking and you discuss before games in high school, you always would vomit. And as a nerve, but then you also talked about how your dad, who was a basketball coach, would do this as well.
See, this wasn't yes.
Yeah.
He used to be a coach, and I would be in his locker rooms before games, and he'd give his pep talk, and then he'd go in the restroom, stick his fingers down his throat, and throw up.
Yeah.
And a lot of times it was dry heaves, and I'd just hear him in there. But that was how you got ready for a game. Yeah. I don't know if he did that when he played. I just know he did it. We never talked about it, but then I started doing it.
Right.
I did it out of nerves. He brought his whole team to watch like a third grade game of mine.
Yeah.
I didn't know they were coming. I went out on the court, puked everywhere at midcourt. big throw up. And they cleaned it up. I felt like Superman after that. I was ready to go. And from that moment, I was a regular puker. I puked every single game from third grade till my second or third year in the NBA. And then I was just like, and I would stick my fingers down my throat.
Right.
If I was playing bad, one of my teammates might be like, bro, did you stick your finger down your throat? Go in there and throw up.
But I'm reading this, and
I didn't realize that. That's crazy.
This is anxiety, man.
Yeah,
and it's also anxiety. Your dad had a similar situation. And when did you face that? When?
Out of rehab. The last time. 2014. Yeah. I've been clean for 9 years. I'm not the model. I smoke marijuana. But I use medical marijuana.
Yeah.
I have a Coors Light from time to time.
Okay.
I have 9 years clean from opioids. I think I really started delving. I hit rock. I was broke.
Yeah.
I was broken. I'd embarrassed myself, my family, my kids, my ex-wife, all of my friends, and my friends' kids that looked up to me.
Yeah.
I felt like, man, if you're going to live, you better start tackling some of why you do the things you do.
Your dad is in here a lot.
Yeah.
Tough on you. I mean, one night time you scored 40 points, you come home, dad's going to like me, and he was mad that he didn't play better defense.
Yeah.
And I played collegiate tennis. My dad, sometimes I think, if he would have been harder on me, I could have been a better pro.
Well,
and I'm thinking, well, which one is it? I don't want that.
Yeah.
But I also wouldn't mind making a couple more bucks playing tennis.
Right.
So what's the balance, dude?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know, because to be honest, I never in my life, my dad played professional basketball. He played college.
Yeah.
I never in my life, my whole life, was on the floor with my dad playing basketball. He never rebounded for me. He never did any of that stuff. Also, I didn't want him to do that. I was focused on what I was doing. I was watching his teams, watching everything he did, listening to everything. I was absorbing it. And I think he knew that I honestly think he knew that I would be too nice and maybe fizzle out as a college player or whatever.
Right.
He knew I had the talent.
Yeah.
The problem is I did very much similar things with my own son.
Yeah.
And he didn't have the same talent. He was way tougher than I was.
Right.
But I treated him almost like my dad treated me sometimes. I was better.
Yeah.
But still I think that's what we're all trying to do.
It's a little
better than our parents.
Yeah.
But it's a hard balance. Yeah. And becoming a professional basketball player was a dream come true. And that's the one thing my dad, it's complicated.
Yeah.
I love him to death.
Of course.
I appreciate everything he's done for me. My mom, the same way.
Yeah.
Are there some things I wish we'd have done differently? Yeah. Who's not that way?
I mean, my mom's here, And there she is. And there's,
On Black Woman History Night.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and here's a list of things she should have done better. That's a joke. That's a joke. You know that, Mom. What do you have to say to people listening who might be middle school phenom in a sport or high school phenom in a sport? Everything's in front of them, it seems like. And there's a reality of this that you have lived. What do you say to somebody who might be in the throes of addiction right now? Do you have a message or a thought?
Man, I guess it's really just find somebody to talk to. I had so much pride that, you know, I was this King Rex type thing, this image, and I had so much pride about not living up to anything. I had all these secret, you know, insecurities, and, you know, your pride can get in the way a lot. And once you let that move a little bit, then you can start to see a light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah.
However, I also recommend therapy. If I would have, if I'd have been able to have therapy, like as a teenager, 18, 19 years old, I feel like, I don't know if it would have changed anything, but I know that I had a better shot of managing the stuff that goes along with being a popular and kind of famous athlete.
That's a great message. Thank you for this book. I loved it. You're the man. Rex Chapman, everybody.
Explore more shows from the Daily Show podcast universe by searching The Daily Show, wherever you get your podcasts. Watch The Daily Show weeknights at 11, 10 Central on Comedy Central, and stream full episodes anytime on Paramount Plus.
This has been a Comedy Central podcast.